Hello, my name is Michelle Yenachan, the Wandering Book Collector, and this is my podcast, Conversations with Writers Exploring What's Informed Their Books and Their Lives Around Themes of Movement, Memory, Sense of Place, Borders, Identity, Belonging, and Home. The Wandering Book Collector podcast is supported by Abercrombie & Kent. And a flag for us too here, if you like the podcast, please take a moment to rate us on the app you use to tune in. All we long for is that our brilliant guests be read more and heard more, and strong ratings help make that happen. Thank you in advance. I'm joined by the writer and screen and stage actor, Sophie Ward, to discuss her latest book, The Schoolhouse. It follows her debut novel, Love and Other Thought Experiments, longlisted for the Booker. And before that, A Marriage Proposal, The Importance of Equal Marriage and What It Means for All of Us. Sophie, welcome to the Wandering Book Collector.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Your latest book, Sophie, The Schoolhouse, has echoes of your own childhood, I think. You attended an experimental school in the 1970s. And the character of Isabel in your book also has a similar experience of not learning a traditionally academic curriculum. It's something all writers do, of course, harvesting from personal life experience, whether fiction or non-fiction. Do you feel you have been particularly well endowed with writing material, given your very rich tapestry of life?
Yes, it's funny that, isn't it? I mean, I'm one of the phrases that I grew up with was, if anything was ever particularly challenging, it was character building. And I guess that's, you know, making lemonade out of lemons. When things get difficult, at least you know that something good will come out of it. And I don't know about character, but certainly story for me definitely came out of a rich and an unusual childhood. You know, I mean, everybody's childhood has its own challenges. And I wouldn't say mine was, you know, particularly difficult or anything. It was just unusual. It was very peripatetic. My dad was an actor. We traveled a lot. And so my education, as well as going to an experimental school, was interrupted a lot by travel. And then my own career, because I started work myself when I was 10.
My eldest daughter is 10. I can't imagine her doing anything except kind of slightly brushing her teeth on time.
Well, I mean, really, that's how it should be. I think there's an investigation now about whether or not children should be actors, because they're not usually allowed to work in any other profession. It's a bit odd.
Well, might I ask what other personal experiences you've shoehorned into your books?
Well, the school that I went to was for differently abled children as well as able-bodied children. So that's one of the themes of The Schoolhouse, is this sort of integrated education. So not just that the policy was sort of Montessori-based, but that the actual experience for all of us children was very integrated. And that was an extraordinary opportunity for 7 years to be. We didn't have classrooms or lessons, but we did have this very mixed ability group of children in one room in East London, and that taught me so many different things about people and what really made a person was nothing to do with how you looked or what you could do, but to do with, well, I think of it as your consciousness or your I'm also quite comfortable with the word soul, but like the sort of inner qualities that you bring to your life and actions you make. So that was something I very much wanted to build into that book, The Schoolhouse. I think probably place as well, and I know obviously that's very relevant to this podcast, but I grew up in North London and East London, and I wanted to convey that sort of urban feel, but at the same time you can walk. There's so many green spaces that are slightly odd with railways over them, and then a canal, and then cows, and then huge estates of council housing, and all this mixture of people and place. I thought I really wanted to build that into it. And I also wanted to bring in family relationships, and I think there's a few different kinds of families in the schoolhouse, and you know, that very strong, there's the very strong mother-daughter relationships, and also the sort of backstory of other relationships and the different echoes in families and things like that. So, yeah.
I mean, it was a jolt for me to read in your acknowledgements of that book this. You wrote, "I write about flaws and frailties and guilt from my own continued familiarity with those conditions." It's such a brief line, yet makes me want to ask a lot, of course, but at least to ask how you take those conditions or emotions and insert them into your books. If it's very direct, for example, "I feel this, so therefore this character might feel this."
Well, no, I mean, obviously there's things that I feel, but also, you know, I spent my whole life gathering other people's stories or trying to convey other people's emotions using my body and imagination to try and interpret other writers' words and stories and fill in the gaps to make whole characters. So that's been my sort of whole life experience, really. You know, I was making plays when I was a toddler, practically, and then doing it professionally from when I was young. And that's how I see the world. So I guess I've got this whole, it's funny because I've got a terrible memory about nearly everything in life, but I file away all these emotions and stories and reactions, and I guess that's those are the things that I'm bursting to talk about when I'm writing, is how people are feeling. But it's not necessarily something I felt, but I've certainly things that I understand.
Well, it's a very light touch, that statement in your acknowledgements, which for me was similar to what your book character, Detective Sergeant Carter, flicked at in reference to her own childhood. It felt very faithful to reality, if a little mysterious, because that's often how life can be, that you might get hints from someone, but little more when it comes to buried childhoods. And I wondered if that was the point of keeping it opaque, reflecting reality in a way, or was it more to build a page turner?
Well, I want people to be able to bring their own interpretations to what I'm writing. I don't want it to be just me that's telling the story, a bit like being an actor as well, you know, that the audience or the observer is so much part of the story. So I do leave space for people to bring their own ideas in. Also, particularly with Carter, I felt like I would like to write more books about her, and I'm still sort of discovering things about her myself. And so some of the layers to her character, I felt, could go into other books as well. That was part of my plan.
How intriguing. I sense that you see this upside and also downside to the education that was offered at the schoolhouse and for yourself in your own childhood. As a nascent writer, what did you think that unconventional education give you, and what did it not give you?
Well, I was on the back foot for a long time, certainly. I didn't really understand all kinds of things about structures that I think other people would understand. So patterns and structures were very hard for me to understand in terms of history and geography. I didn't really have any knowledge of those things and how they might all work together. So everything was very little bits of things I was desperately trying to piece together. And then when I did go to a more conventional school, I was so behind. So I then acted up, and, you know, my pride took hold of me, sort of pretending that I wasn't interested in certain things, and that which I obviously really regret now, but I have to take responsibility for those those things now. And I there was even a cupboard in my secondary school where I could fit in, and I used to go in there, and the other children would let me and pretend that I was away, was at home or ill or whatever, just so that I didn't have to go through the humiliation of not understanding what was going on in the class. So of course, then I just got further and further behind. So then so that in terms of strictly academic sense, I did definitely miss out. But then I had to sort of compensate. I read a lot. I've always loved reading, so that was fine. And that gave me a lot of understanding, and a little bit of knowledge. And then when I was in my 30s, I went back to school. And I think that impulsion to find out things myself came from, sometimes from the actual structure, because Montessori is about the child being independent and solving problems and doing what they want to do. So there was a little bit of that, but also just, you know, wanting to know what other people were talking about, being able to be part of conversations about things and understand the world a bit better. So, and by then I'd got my own children, and I wanted to be able to help them navigate their own education. I was the first person in my family to go to university, and I didn't go till I was 35. So I wanted to be able to help them do that as well. And so it gave me, I guess, the desire to learn, and as well as, you know, an understanding about all kinds of different people that at a more conventional school I wouldn't have had.
And perhaps it also gave you fearlessness to write bravely, because Love and Other Thought Experiments, your debut, was genre busting. It straddled time and place. For example, a character comes back unexpectedly, and one chapter is told from the perspective of an aunt, and some of the book is set well into the future. And then you followed it with The Schoolhouse, a much more traditional novel, and brave also, I think, because of course many were watching to see what you were, a book along lister, did next. So maybe that education, you know, gave some freedom and courage and original thinking that sometimes beaten out of us in more traditional curriculum.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that definitely is part of it. And
my romanticism, maybe I'm romanticizing it.
No, I mean, you know, it was pretty rough and ready what was going on there. But and I'm never quite sure, you know, sometimes we're lucky to be born with a certain resilience and confidence. And I think that is hugely lucky. And I do feel that. And I'm sure some of that came from my parents too. You know, they were very young when they had me, and they were very busy and sort of chaotic, but I know they loved me, and so there was a sort of I wouldn't say I'm fearless. I've got loads and loads of fears, but I try to get on with things anyway.
It's a brave book, that one. So in a sense that maybe some of this, for example, permission to use your imagination like you did so wildly in Love and Other Thought Experiments. I mean, that's something that traditional school can inhibit, but maybe that just comes naturally to you anyway, you know, ever the daydreamer.
Yes, I'm definitely the daydreamer, staring out the window, away with the fairies, all of those things, everybody, or with my head in a book and not hearing what other people are saying. Tenuous grip on reality, I think one of my reports said. So yes, I think that it probably just is my character, but I'm sorry to hear you say, and it sounds like you might be saying that from experience, that conventional education can move those things or try to smooth out the rougher edges, maybe.
I think so. I mean, as you say, it's quite individualistic, and some might be tougher than others to keep true to what they want to learn and how they want to learn. But yeah, I don't know if we've got it right. It's such a tough one. And as a mum too, like you, you kind of watch these pure, unsculpted forms learning in particular ways that, you know, a system or a state dictates. It's hard because they're so pure, and then they're not, they kind of are trying to be a little bit cloned and prepared for the world, as you put it yourself, you know, that allows them to be in conversations and allows them to feel confident in the world that we've created. But yes, of course, you therefore lose some of your slight, maybe kind of quirky, unusual characteristics.
Yeah, of course. I mean, there's everything conspires. Obviously, we are in a society, and that ant-like quality of needing to be part of a system, for the system to work for everyone's benefit. And yet all the really interesting strides forward happen because of the outsiders, because of the people who don't fit that mold. So yeah, it's that balance, isn't it? I know, and I agree with you totally. As a parent, that's tricky. I think the thing is that you want to be able to give your children and give yourself the tools, the resources to be able to problem solve and find things out, without necessarily just sort of downloading loads of information.
As a child, you said it was peripatetic, you know, with your acting parents. Was that tough at the time, or was it actually energizing?
I loved it. I was really happy traveling, and I wasn't that, you know, I know other people who found it really difficult, that they always wanted to be at school on the first day and they never were, so you weren't ever sitting next to the kids you wanted to sit next to, and you didn't really know what was going on. I didn't really know what was going on anyway, so maybe that didn't matter so much. And you know, we'd go, we're living, it sounds glamorous, I mean, sometimes it was, sometimes it wasn't, but you know, you're living in hotels and you're seeing other countries and seeing extraordinary things, being on film sets and having the privilege to go to you know, villages in Morocco, or school. I went to school in York for a bit, and that was so invaluable to me. I loved it. I was never unhappy about traveling. And I did do that a lot with my own kids, actually. But I did have the conversation with them, you know, when this feels like you'd really just want to be going to school and have a more like term time situation, let me know. But for most of their primary school, they were in Russia and Zimbabwe and America and all over Europe. And as far as I understand it, the way they say it to me now, they did enjoy it too.
And where did you love? And was there ever a thought that you might, you know, not just wander, but also maybe put down roots somewhere else?
I don't know. I mean, London is definitely a base. I don't really mind particularly where I am. I'm always interested in it, but I don't have a sort of thing where I mean, of course, there's loads of places I love being in. And if I was going to on a holiday, or somebody said, oh, you're going to do a film there or a play there, I'd be very happy to go. But I am maybe over adaptable. I'm so used to being in a caravan or a dressing room or a hotel room and making up my own world in that space. I think one film I was on for 2 months and I had about three lines and everything was going wrong, so they kept me on and kept me on. And I was in a 10 by 6 room from 6 in the morning till 8 at night every day for 2 months, basically. And I was happy as Larry. Physically, the locations are often very odd and remote. The nice thing about traveling with work is that you, as I know you know too, you get to be with people who are actually living and working there. You're not just there as a tourist, so you get to see the actual working of the city and understand the people more. But I'm also, if I've got books, and now obviously with also if you have access to the world online, there's just so much that can go on in your head.
Yes, your head. I feel in the schoolhouse, this sense of homelessness for Isabel, one of your characters, although she has a home, it's as if in trying to stop her past catching up with her, she tries to stay anonymous in the world and unnoticeable. It's as if home is the last thing she wants, actually a dangerous place to be. And I wondered where you found your anchor points over the years.
As opposed to Isabel, I mean, obviously she's trying to protect herself from that trauma, from her own part that she felt she played in it, as well as the antagonists that were involved, who she now feels she's at risk from. I think what she feels most at risk from is everybody finding out what happened, and rather than necessarily her own physical danger. Yes, so that's different for me. I fortunately didn't have that experience. And I guess anchor points for me really are people. You know, if I'm lucky enough to be in a long-term relationship, and I've got children and grandchildren, and I'm in a four-generation family, I'm still got my mom. And so, you know, there's a lot there, isn't there? There's a lot when you've got family and close friends, and that's very busy, just even you know, looking after and maintaining and being with those people. So I guess it's people that are mostly anchor points for me, yes.
Reflecting on your previous novel, Sophie, Love and Other Thought Experiments, I wanted to quote something short from the book to you. "Welcome home, Captain Price," which is the voice of the Earth-based headquarters. And then in Captain Price's head, you write, "Sure, home, if home meant danger, loneliness, and unacceptable risk of failure." And Captain Price, or Arthur, as we know him mostly in the book, has actually just landed in a shallow crater on the smaller of Mars's two moons. You add that he was glad to be there. I slightly love that quote I've chosen, especially for those listeners who haven't yet read your book, because it's quite out there, literally. But on the back of that quote, Sophie, about home, I wanted to ask you where home is for you now. I think a very London girl, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm at home. Not that often because of my other job, but that is where I think of as home, is Hackney. I also, I feel very strongly that home isn't necessarily a safe place for a lot of people. This idea of, you know, everybody's going to be rushing home all the time. When I came out, because I'm married to a woman, I was very aware of how many kids on the street were homeless because their families had rejected them. And I think something like a third of homeless people under 25 were LGBTQ+. I feel that so strongly, that there's, for all kinds of reasons, there are loads of people growing up where home isn't safe. I don't like that romanticization of, oh, you know, home. It's like, because that's not available to so many people. And now, obviously, I think I'm always particularly aware of how many people are homeless in the world sense. And how we can make that more of a sort of open concept of what home is. It's not 2 + 2 in a 2 up, 2 down, you know.
So was it always straightforward, though, answering that question for you? Have you always had kind of a place, a sanctuary, maybe?
Mm. I think books were my sanctuary as much as anything, and the world of the imagination. You know, children are very vulnerable, aren't they? And they're so much at the whim of everybody else saying where they're going to be and what they're going to do. And I did retreat very often just into the world of my imagination. Not that I was in danger or anything. I wasn't, but I very much had that sense of, well, that's where I've got my superpower is in my head. You know, I can't say what I'm going to do today because everybody else is going to tell me what I've got to do. But when I've got a moment, I can escape from it.
Going back to kind of your activism, if I can call it that, your first, well, in the LGBTQ plus community, your first book, A Marriage Proposal, was a nonfiction short about same-sex marriage. Would you call that book a form of activism?
I guess so. It was a cri de coeur, you know, at the time, the idea that same-sex couples could get married was being discussed and argued over politically in the UK. And we'd been given the opportunity to have a civil union, which was great because legally that offered a lot of protections that we hadn't had before. But the word marriage came laden with so many meanings for different people. And I think I wanted also to look at how there were some heterosexual couples who, with the best will in the world, did not want same-sex couples to suffer, but they didn't feel comfortable with the idea of marriage because they'd got a definition in their head and you know, a lifetime of experience and millennia of historical examples. And it was so hard for people to push against that. And I know there was a lot of sort of talk about Orwellian changes of meaning. And hard as it was as a lesbian to hear sort of one's existence and rights being discussed that much, I could understand it to some extent, that it was a new concept for a lot of people. So I wanted to write the book not just for same-sex couples or their families and friends, but also for people who didn't really know why was it so important for a same-sex couple. If we were so different and we were, you know, being so rebellious and were trying to make our own lives, why did we want to hang on the coattails of a patriarchal tradition? And sure enough, there were plenty of gay people who felt that too, you know. So I just wanted to say why it was important personally for me, and also historically how that has happened in lots of different societies. There have been some sort of same-sex unions permitted, and why this word marriage meant so much.
The gay characters in your novels, particularly in The Schoolhouse, I felt are just kind of there, like Carter and her girlfriend, who are a lesbian couple who happen to be police officers, for example. They're just part of the novel's landscape. And is that the point, in fact, that it doesn't need to be a discussion or a debate anymore?
Yeah, I definitely think we're at a different, you know, in this country, in the UK anyway, we're at a slightly different point now, and we're moving on from, I mean, coming out stories will always be big, and, you know, your family's acceptance and social acceptance will never, I don't think, completely be not a story. But the nowadays, most people know lots of gay couples, and it's not such a big deal. And if they don't know them personally, you know, they've got lots of examples in art, literature and on television. And so it's sort of moving on from that, putting the stories in. But also there will still be particular obstacles that couple come across that a straight couple might not meet. I mean, The Schoolhouse is set in the 90s, and there was still a lot of, well, there still is a lot of chauvinism in the police force. I think there's been a lot of stories recently, particularly about the Met, but also homophobia, and, you know, how to navigate that, and, you know, your career versus your personal life, and all of those discussions.
So is Carter appearing again? Is this detective coming up? You've given me kind of a slightly tantalizing clue that she might.
Well, the book I'm writing at the moment is not. It's more No, it's slightly more not experimental, but anyway, it's not in set in that world. And then the next my next book will be, I'm hoping, will be back to a Carter story. Yes.
Two ahead. So, can you tell me a little? Can you say anything about the current work in progress?
Yeah, so I'm just looking at this particular period in the 1970s and the connections between war, the war that was going on in Vietnam and the displaced people from that, and then how the sort of powerful some powerful poets and writers managed to reach out to different people with the power of language and ideas and lift them up and help them to grow up. And language is the first thing that gets taken away when your country's invaded, isn't it? The power that takes over takes away your language, makes you speak the language of their country. And then also in a smaller way, language is so powerful. Even with laws changing now, now that I can say I'm married, that's a much more powerful thing and conveys to people so much than, well, this is my girlfriend or my partner, my businessy partner. So yes, just how words and ideas can travel across countries and boundaries and reach a child in the middle of a country trying to grow up and learn.
So it's interesting. I'm not far from Vietnam right now, and the first time I went there, which is a very long time ago, but I was taken by the fact that we all call it the Vietnam War outside of Vietnam. But of course, in Vietnam, they've had many, many wars. It's not the Vietnam War there. It's the U.S. Vietnam War of the 70s. It's very specific, and even that, I think, of that kind of hijacking of the language, so that globally it's become known as the Vietnam War, but for the people who actually suffered immeasurable
Yes,
boundaries,
absolutely. Yeah.
it's even got a different name. And
Yes. And also so navigating that as a writer is not my world to appropriate as well. And so I'm looking at it from trying to tell the story from other points of view, which hopefully conveys some of the things that have happened to other people, but without trying to appropriate in people's stories, as you say, that language is so, and it's so embedded in me, the Vietnam War is just, but I am looking at it particularly from that American prism and those American soldiers who went over and came back, and meanwhile all the protests and the sort of uprisings that were happening in Europe as well, and the students trying to process what was happening and get some rights, some civil rights established.
it sounds like another layered book of interconnected stories. Are you thinking, Sophie, at all about scripts or plays at all, about penning any of those different format?
I'm not thinking about plays because the difficulty with that is that you, a bit like my other job as an actor, you write the play and then you have to wait for it to be put on, and that's then at the mercy of so many other people. Now, of course, that's also true with books, that there's a huge collaboration that happens. But nevertheless, once you've written a book, it exists and someone can read it, and you don't have to go through 5,000 meetings about various things. And I've spent so much of my life waiting to get jobs, or having a job and thinking it's going to finish, and then you're out of work again, and blah blah blah, blah, the whole process starting again. It's a very powerless feeling. So I really, really enjoy the autonomy of being able to write whenever I want to write. So plays in that way for me sort of bring me back to that world of being at the mercy of so many other things. Scripts as well, absolutely. But if something was already happening, I mean, I'd be interested in adaptation. I like adapting things, so I'd be more comfortable with that possibly.
Because if you could adapt your own and maybe be in it, which character would you like to play? Ant, you can't say the
I don't have I don't you know that's what I'd like to play. I don't write with an idea of being in anything that I've written. I know people do write with they cast things in their mind. I don't have that. In fact, I don't have a very good visual memory for people. I often don't recognize people. It's more about who somebody is rather than I don't really recognize what people look like most of the time. It's not complete face blindness, but there's something there. I don't think I'd like to be in any of my books. I don't think I want to be. They feel very separate to me.
unless you're an insect.
The best thing about being an actor is totally not being yourself. The hardest thing is if it's closer to you, that's the harder it gets. So yeah, I mean, I'm maybe a sort of an astronaut of some description. I would be. I mean, I'd love to go to Mars anyway. If we could actually go to Mars, I'd be straight there.
I'll be your wingman.
Great. I know you're much traveled.
Oh, well, not yet to outer space, but happily join you on that voyage. So if you do wrap, I just wanted to ask, as such an sympathetic and empathetic writer to so many, I think, what's your favorite place to write?
I really like to be outdoors if I can be. And if there's a tree, then I'm very, very happy because I want to look at a bird or a leaf or a butterfly or a blade of grass or an ant and let my mind go to that other place. I think it's an alpha brain state, I think it is, which is like the child's brain, where it's the most free. So that's the fewest distractions. But these little connections and beauty that's where I'm happiest.
I mean, and is that in a park in London or in the Cotswolds or in Florida or in Morocco? Where is that?
Any of those. I've got a little space at the back of my flat, and that's got an extraordinary array of different things going on. There's parties in the houses behind me, and there's goats in the garden next door to me. This is in a Hackney terrace. I'm also in and live in an Orthodox Jewish community. So there's all kinds of amazing things happening where I am. But there's also a tree. And so I'm very happy there. But I'm also happy on a beach or, but being outdoors, yeah.
Sophie Ward, thank you for joining me on The Wandering Book Collector.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure to be here with you.
And my thanks to the supporter of this podcast, Abercrombie & Kent.